Hey folks, thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we get started here, I just wanted to make sure that you know that Off Camera, besides being just a podcast, is so much more. If you haven't done it yet, go to offcamera.com and subscribe. It's free, it's super easy, and then you'll have access to everything we do at Off Camera. You'll get updates on what we're doing, you can find out about the television show, the magazine, and so much more. So just take a minute and check it out. Also, if you notice, there's some new music under my voice right now. And that's thanks to our friend Pete Droge, who composed this music exclusively for Off Camera. So now, when I talk about our lovely sponsors, you also have some lovely music to listen to. Here's one of those sponsor messages right now. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code OFFCAMERA at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with musician, writer, actress, and comedian, Carrie Brownstein. Most of you probably know Carrie Brownstein for her work on the brilliantly quirky Portlandia, but if you're a music fan, you'll know her from her fiery and completely original rock band, Sleater-Kinney. After this episode, I think you'll also know her as the embodiment of a true artist and creative. But first, some background. When you leave your home at 17 and spend the next 15 years creating every possible substitute for one, it can be exhilarating, but pretty exhausting. Either way, it makes for a great story, and that's just what she has in her new book, Hungry Makes Me a Modern Girl. Brownstein began her search as a fan of bands, then by rising to iconic status in a band, and ultimately by breaking it up for the perceived shelter of various and sundry office buildings. What struck me about this book, beyond its deplorable lack of drugs and debauchery, is that unlike most rock memoirs, it doesn't just chronicle the big sensational moments. It takes you on a parallel artistic journey that explores what drove the need to create, and sadly for Sleater-Kinney in 2006, the need to destroy. As a storyteller, Brownstein brings us right into the scene that gave rise to the band, but also confined it, and how it felt to be naive, hungry, and young, navigating the rise of a band and all that came with it, all while looking for someone or something to hold and claim her. In this episode, we talk about the birth, death, and happy rebirth of Sleater-Kinney, the disparity between the perception and reality of fame, what she's learned from the process of writing her book, and what might be next for Portlandia. We can all relate to the need to fit in and connect. Brownstein just took it to a level that most of us don't. As an artist and seeker, it drives her need to both embrace and contain the chaos around her and make it profound. I think she'll always be a seeker, but at least she's discovered where to look for home. At this point, you're probably expecting a conversation filled with Wizard of Oz metaphors about no place like home, but we went with boats and sailors and anchors instead. Don't worry, we stopped short of regaling you with sea shanties. It'll all make sense when you listen to the episode, believe me. Brownstein starts her book and her journey as a fan. At the end of our conversation, I think you'll be a big fan of hers. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Sam.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for doing this. I've been a fan of what you do for a long time, and you're kind of the perfect off-camera guest because you are a writer, you're a musician, you're an actor, and I think you're a really original, like, fearless artist that is always going for something new, and you're not satisfied with just having, you know, a stable career. You always seem to push yourself, and I think that's so interesting. And you recently wrote a book mm-hmm. called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, and I read it in one sitting. And I've read a lot of, I don't want to call it a rock autobiography or memoir, because that's not really saying what it is. But in that genre, I've read a lot of books in that genre, and I found it to be completely original and different. And it took me more into the psyche of what it's like to be really thinking and feeling about the experience and not just sort of, you know,
filling your treasure chest full of stories and things like that. And I just found it was a completely original read, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But what did you feel like you wanted to share? Or why sit down and write about yourself at this age when you still have so much living?
Right. Yes, I do. Well, hopefully. I was writing a book that was a little more theoretical, a little more cultural criticism based. And I felt like what was always interesting about those stories was my own experience. You know, that was the unique perspective that I was bringing to it. I wrote for a while for NPR Music, and I had a blog for them called Monitor Mix, and it had a very conversational tone, which I think helped me become a better writer. Less pedagogical, less esoteric. Just sometimes when you write, you take on this almost like formal tone that can be
right.
Alienating and completely unnecessary. So I don't know. I guess as I was thinking about those blog posts, which drew a lot from my personal life, and the previous book I had pitched, and realizing that the stuff from my personal life was also the most interesting from that, I realized that I had a story that was mostly just about being a fan, which is really where I start this book, and feeling like an outsider,
right.
Finding your way into a world that can ultimately be your salvation, but is so much about, it's about not staying outside of something. It's about participating in your own life, like being a willful protagonist in whatever you're doing. And I think a lot about the difference between action and movement. And I think, you know, movement, we're always moving. I mean, we live very frenetic and kinetic lives, but action is intentional. And I think a lot of this book and why I wanted to write it is just kind of trying to figure out how to just make decisions that put you at the center of who you want to be. So it's a lot of, I guess there's just a lot about that. And I don't know, the story of Slater Kinney and the world we came up in hasn't really been told yet from somebody in that scene.
Inside, right.
Yeah, so there was a lot of reasons, but I don't know, hopefully people will like it.
Well, that part really struck with me about the fan, the mm-hmm. idea that you started as a fan, but mm-hmm. the way you describe a fan is interesting in the book because I think it's the way you describe an artist. Because you describe early in the book about some of your friends and their experiences being a fan versus
yes.
yours,
yes.
where it was like about the clothes or it was about the fashion or about seeing who they saw at a concert. But mm-hmm. for you, it was like, wait a minute, it's all about like seeing these people, emoting or sharing or whatever it is. Because I think a lot of people can be fans and have no desire to take it any further.
Absolutely.
Was there a moment when you felt like, oh, I'm not just a fan. I actually feel so connected because I want to be doing that.
Yeah, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. First, you know, going to these big pop concerts like Madonna or George
right.
Michael. But even in that moment, seeing somebody whose life and whose level of fame, I don't even know if I imagined then that I would... that I wanted that much of what they had, but seeing how they could captivate an audience and elicit such strong emotions, I didn't want to be a receptacle for that. Like, I wanted to be the instigator. And that was a huge differentiation between my experience of the show and someone else's. And then it really took going to smaller shows, which I talk about in the book as well, where you the mechanics of it are broken down, and I wanted to be a progenitor. I wanted to be within that and creating it, and I also really saw it as a language that I and a means to communicate, a means to sort of fulfill and sort of take care of all of the, like, you know, chaotic messiness in my life, like to just kind of nullify that, to speak to it, to reach someone else that felt like that. And I really saw art and creativity as the only thing in this world that is capable of encapsulating a messiness and making it feel profound.
That's so interesting, because you started the book by saying, I've always felt unclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I feel like, well, a lot of us feel and claim, but mm-hmm. not a lot of us create like an entire scene and a means like to have all of that you just said. And I wonder what drove that. Was it this desire to be creative and to make things and to connect, or was it also like a need for, like a more basic need of security and safety? And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think in my life there were, and I go into this in the book, there was definitely a paucity of structures, of normalcy, of family that resembled anything conventional or traditional. And so I set out from a place of unsteadiness. And like you said, feeling unclaimed. And so it's like you're laying down the tracks as you're going, you know, like in a cartoon. Like,
did you know what you were doing, or do you think it was just like instinctual that this is what I have to do?
I think it was quite instinctual. I think there was a real scrappiness and a real survivalist mode that luckily took on the form of music instead of something more extreme. You know, I mean, I think
Sure. Because
you know, survival and seeking safety and comfort, you know, that can be a very derelict, dark process. And I think that luckily, like music, especially the punk rock, you know, which was what really took hold of me in my teen years, that is the perfect conduit for, I think, you know, laying down your own tracks, like setting your own journey. You're in this wave of people that are feeling antagonistic, that are feeling angry, that are feeling contrarian. And I think eventually, as you like move through that world with that can be very angry, it's like it has a calming feeling once you sort of are surrounding yourself. It's like fire meets fire, and eventually you kind of settle down. But I think it was really exciting to be in such a galvanic moment for a while. I think that steadied me, you know, to just like, it's like you're running alone, and then you suddenly realize, like, oh my gosh, there's all these other runners with me. Now we can just slow down.
Well, you do a great job of describing the scenes and the factions, and you talk about almost like land grabs of people claiming mm-hmm. certain scenes. And I, you know, I grew up in Fullerton, and it was sort of the first wave of punk rock in my area. It was mm-hmm. Agent Orange and the Adolescents, and they all went to my high school. And uh-huh. and it was this thing. It was certainly an alternative to, like, I was a little skinny kid that, you know, didn't fit in at all. And so mm-hmm. I think I had that same experience. I didn't take it to where you did, but I also find the irony of that you explained so well in your book, of the idea that this scene that you thought takes in all the cast-offs and weirdos and seekers has just as many rules. And it turns out that in creating these scenes, they may be more stringent in their rules than the mainstream.
Yeah, and I think by defining themselves in opposition to the mainstream, by default, you know, they had to be strident and had to be, you know, just a little bit didactic. And at first that feels comforting because it's like you feel alienated by the mainstream, and so you replace that with something that still has walls.
Right.
But then eventually you're like, oh, these walls can be just as restricting. You know, I feel it's, you know, I don't feel as unique as I thought I did. You know, it starts to just feel kind of homogenous and constraining. But clearly these are the kinds of things that ended up informing Portlandia, you know, these.
Sure.
So it all kind of fits together, even though the book doesn't get to Portlandia. It kind of, you know, illustrates the seeds that were sown in sort of like shaping how I started to feel about this thing that certainly helped me and certainly I felt such a kinship with. But then there was just a growing skepticism.
Right. I guess that's also adolescence, right? Where first you just want something and you'll go after it anyway. And then you start to see the framework, and then you become an individual, mm-hmm. which you describe so beautifully in your book of that, I mean, often painful process of like going from feeling like you fit in a scene to creating a scene to seeing the limits of it to then, like, you know, seeing your individuality in comparison to that. But you mentioned that the book doesn't get to Portlandia, and it actually really stops at the end of the first incarnation of Sleater-Kinney.
Mm-hmm.
Was that specific, like, I'm going to take this chunk and there's more books coming? Or what made you stop there? Because I feel like the story was just beginning.
Well, one book I was really inspired by was Born Standing Up by Steve Martin, and that's a slim memoir that really takes you from his childhood, up him working at Disneyland, him on the road as a stand-up, like clowning basically, like up until the point he starts at SNL. Like that's where the story ends. It's like all the things, you know, it's like we know the tip of the iceberg for Steve Martin, but like what right. exists under the water. So I liked that. I liked the story of Slater Kinney and the elements of my childhood and younger version of myself that I wanted to tell cohered very nicely. And so I knew I wanted it to stop there, at least in terms of what this was about thematically. And what was strange was that when I started this book, Slater Kinney had no plans of coming back from our very long hiatus.
Right.
And it was almost like through the writing of the book, I exhumed this band. This band started to feel alive again. And it ended up really informing, I think, as I was still sort of tinkering with it, like to feel that it was breathing again, actually really infused the book with, I think, more life and just kind of like a sheen to it that I didn't necessarily feel as I was, you know, the end of the first part is a little sad. And so it was nice to be able to, in the epilogue, you know, it was like, there's the body of the band again. It's back. And it was a nice way, I think, like a nice little button at the end. So I'm very comfortable with the fact that the book doesn't go into Portlandia.
And it's interesting, the analogy of the tip of the iceberg, because mm-hmm. I love the moment when things change in a way that they're never going to go back again. Mm-hmm. And for me, in your book, it was the CMJ account, sort of. Mm-hmm. And you're in New York for the first time, and you're playing CMJ. And I think Thurston Moore from mm-hmm. Sonic Youth is in the audience. And, you know, it's like that palatable thing of, oh, like, this thing they've been pushing uphill, like now it has its own momentum. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, did that feel like that moment for you? Can you talk a little bit about when it stopped being just yours and you saw that it could have a life that was going to be a bit out of your control?
Yeah, I mean, CMJ was definitely part of that trajectory of when things started changing over for us. But yeah, there were definitely moments, you know, I described this show at the Cooler. This is this, you know, show that was oversold to a negligent degree. And like, you know, literally sweat and perspiration dripping from the walls. And us playing that show and kind of just having a sense that like something bigger was happening than this band. Like when you...
What does that feel like from the inside?
You know, it's not... I think a better moment to describe is how the disparity, I think, between what other people perceive you're feeling and what you actually are. Later in the book, I describe a surreal moment where Time Magazine names us the best rock band in America.
Yeah.
And that was a huge deal at the time. You know, print media was very prominent. People definitely read Time and Newsweek. And Greil Marcus was one of the premier rock critics, and he was the one that named us. And, you know, next day on the Today Show, Bryant Gumbel was like, who the heck is this band?
Right.
But, you know, nevertheless, we were very excited. Like, this is a huge stamp of validation for a band that, you know, has never seen any, like, Grammy nominations. Were not anywhere near, like, a, you know, gold record or platinum record. And suddenly this huge stamp of...
You're not getting envelopes full of cash in
the mail. Yeah, no. We're, you know, just touring in a van. And so I guess the disparity there is that we come back from Europe with all of our gear has been shipped on a pallet. We drive out to the airport, just me, Janet, and Corin, and we load her equipment down broken basement steps past a laundry room where it's mostly filled with cat piss. And then we have no one to help us. And, you know, and it sucked. And we were like, we're the best band in America. So that disparity always exists, I think, with moments that feel from the outside like they're life-changing. You know,
it
was always more reminders of how things still weirdly felt the same.
No one could ever really understand that unless they were in it, mm-hmm. right? And yet... You probably go away from that CMJ week or from that Time Magazine experience, and people assume you're somewhere else, right?
Oh yeah, we came from quite an unadorned, very modest kind of scene. But as I say in the book, there was always part of me sort of admiring of the people that kind of were able to cloak themselves in persona, because you know if it was a persona, our persona was authenticity. Our persona, you know, and so then you're very laid bare, and then there is almost no separation between you and your music, and which is fine. I mean, I think that's why people relate so intensely to our music.
Yeah.
But there's just kind of no hiding behind it. You know, there's no, like, we're not coming out on stage and, you know, with 30 people and crazy costumes, which, you know,
right.
maybe we'll do on the next record. So yeah, I mean, I think it is good to stay connected, but I think that there are ways, though, of striving for a certain kind of freedom and an untethering in art and creativity that is to be admired, you know.
That's, yeah. Well, look, I think it happened so young for you, mm-hmm. that I imagine how hard it would be to sort of keep developing as an artist with all of that distraction too.
Mm-hmm.
And even not on the, you know, we're not talking on the level of Nirvana or something. We're mm-hmm. talking about, though, somebody who, you know, you were, when all that started happening, you were what, 21 mm-hmm. or something like that? So, I mean, there's a story in the book about this meeting at Matador Records.
Oh gosh, yes.
And, I mean, you did.
I can't wait for them to read that.
But it's, to stop myself, it's like, you know, did you consider when you wrote this book that now you'd have to actually talk about your life? You know
what? Yes and no. It's funny because I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a fiction writer. And I was saying that for me, and I think it's the same with fiction too, but there's a time when you're writing the book that it feels very mechanical. You're thinking about sentence structure and syntax. You're thinking about, you know, is the flow of this sentence good? Does it have too many clauses? Am I overusing the same word? Like, it becomes, you're thinking about the infrastructure and the architecture, and you can read it with this and feel almost impassive and just kind of, you know, detached, because
right.
it's, you know, it's writing. It's rigorous on one level. It is just rote and mechanical, and it's only later, I think, that you get a sense of what you've put down. There's some, I mean, a lot of people have described, you know, parts of the book as raw or very personal.
And, yeah.
I think while writing it, you know, it's not, because it's not just like, it's not a diary. You're not just playing. I mean, you really, it's construction. And so only later, as I had any sense of kind of the whole of the book, did I start to realize, huh? Yeah, this will be interesting when this person reads this. For certain people, like Corin Tucker, uh-huh. who's my bandmate, and as one of our mutual friends just said to Corin, she's like, "You're kind of the second main character in the book besides Carrie." But with Corin, I actually on Slater Kinney, the recent Slater Kinney tours, I read her passages of the book.
We
were on a bus tour, so you get these day rooms, and we would sit in the hotel room during the day and. I just wanted her. Well, first of all, I had to ask her. I needed her to verify certain things.
It's almost like you're not fact checking like a journalist, but still, it's your account, and you want to check it, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's fine if my perception is a little bit different, but you know, there was definitely certain accounts that I wanted, you know, to at least be verifiable, of course, but also just because it is when you expose yourself, you're by default exposing the people around you.
Yeah,
and. I think especially for Corin, you know, it was just important to me. She's such a close friend of mine and my oldest friend, sorry, that there was nothing that she was like, don't put that in there or something like that.
Right.
And there wasn't. In fact, it was interesting. She really stopped. Like her critical mind kind of shut off, and it was actually very sweet. I just ended up reading her long passages of the book, and she really loved it. It was a really nice feeling because so much of it is our story.
That's got to be a great fear, though, after you've written it all, to, like, you want her to, you want her to like it, and you want her to say that, you know what I mean? That must have been kind of scary.
It was scary, but one thing I realized, is I think people will be more offended if they're not in it. I've noticed that with other things too, not my own things.
Yeah,
but like,
I was very offended.
I thought I should do a little addendum and bring it in, just like, don't worry, Sam. These are actually the last two pages of the book. It's all about you.
Yeah. Well, we could still do that.
No, it's not public. It's still in like, you know, a couple more months.
Future editions. Get my kids in there.
Yes. I think this is common that people think they're going to be offended by some story you're telling about them, but they're actually more offended that they were omitted from the book.
Well, also, if you're writing an emotional scene, as a writer, you really want to land that scene. Mm-hmm. Like, you really want to make it effective. Mm-hmm. So then a triumph on the page, like, that's what I thought. Like, maybe a triumph on the page later is something like, oh, well, now that's out there.
I felt like that a lot with some of the earlier childhood stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that to me, I think there is a tenderness there. When I kind of went back, I was like, oh, that just seems personal. And it's not, I mean, I don't want people to get the wrong idea. There's nothing salacious in this book, and it's not one of those, like, you know, tearjerker memoir. It's nothing like that. But it's definitely for someone that, you know, I think that I'm, you know, not the most, like, I'm kind of guarded, you know, in my life. I will feel a little more exposed for sure.
Stay with us, because after the break, Carrie talks about sabotaging a meeting with a big record label and other consequences of trying to navigate a band career when you're young and naive. You know, the internet has come a long way. Used to be you had to know some guy that knew some guy that knew how to code and could build you a website, and you had to learn coding yourself, and nothing worked right for months, and you'd get a prototype up and you'd show your friends and then it would crash. But now there's Squarespace. And if you're gonna build a website for anything, whether it's for your band or your restaurant or for your dog or for your love of oysters, Squarespace makes it so easy. The sites look professionally designed regardless of your skill level, and there's no coding required. They have easy-to-use tools, and they give you a free domain if you sign up for a year. That's amazing right there. So here's what you do. You go to squarespace.com, you start your free trial site today, and once you start to kind of poke around, you're going to see how intuitive and easy Squarespace is to use. It's really a company that understands artists and understands creative people, and they make it really easy to build something that feels really unique and personal. So start your free trial site today at squarespace.com. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA to get 10% off of your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And now, back to the show.
So in talking about being really young and having all this sort of happen, and speaking of vulnerability, I think that when I read the account, and I'll paraphrase, it's basically that you were being courted by a bunch of labels, mm-hmm. and Matador is sort of the king of the indies at that time. They mm-hmm. had Liz Phair, they had Pavement, they had Betty Sevier, they had all these cool bands,
yeah.
and they knew what they were doing, and it sounded from the book like you went to this meeting and they had their shit together.
Absolutely.
And it was like this great opportunity, and you end up sort of sabotaging the meeting, and then you end up sticking with Kill Rock Stars because they're mm-hmm. from Olympia and they're mm-hmm. a smaller label. And. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you describe it as, at the time, you know, feeling sort of obligated to stay within your scene and not wanting to have your fans turn their backs on you because you got too big. Like, all these crazy constraints that punks mm-hmm. have at that. But what I read was, well, here's someone really young with no business experience trying mm-hmm. to make a pretty overwhelming decision.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back, do you go, like, guy, I got to give myself a break on that because you were so young.
Absolutely, and I think that's why later in the book when I talk about our booking agent, Bob Lawton, who is a little bit of a de facto manager, and our publicist, Julie Butterfield, and I talk about how, yeah, we were three young people with no management, basically,
right.
and no guidance, no just sort of outside voice of reason to say, like, hey guys, here are the reasons why you might want to go with this label versus this label. This, you know, we had no perspective on it at all. And we basically tore each other to shreds, you know, on all these decisions. And because often operating from a place of fear.
Sure.
And just ignorance, you know, and also self-interest and all the things that you make any decision based on or factor in any decision. But we didn't have anyone else to just say, like, hey, let's calm down. This is actually the logical version of this. This is the rational version. This is the what would be best for you as a business. This might be what's best for you personally. And hopefully that those two things align. Yes, we were very much on our own, you know.
And no one had a parent or someone they would call and say, what do you think? Or was it just not that kind of thing?
We really didn't. It was really, you know, I think that's where our naivete and that, you know, we just really, like, butt up against, you know, a world that was ready to take us on. And we were so ready to take on the world. But there was, like, no interlocutor. Like, we were just, it was like we were two puzzle pieces that we were missing that middle puzzle piece.
Right.
We could not connect it. And so we kind of crammed those two puzzle pieces together. And we're like, oh, okay, I guess we're trying to enter the mainstream. And you're trying to help us, but we missed out on that middle piece. So it's like this awkward fit. And that was kind of the rest of our career.
I could see when all that was happening, it happening sort of quickly in mm-hmm. memory, right? But mm-hmm. when you have to sit down and stop, does the act of writing about your experience make you have to examine it a little more closely than you ever had to before?
Of course. And, you know, there's someone said this. It was like Margaret Atwood or Joyce Carol Oates or Marilyn Robinson. Basically, like, when our memories are these mansions. And when you go to write, they are shacks. You know, they are just these flimsy structures. And when we think back on something, we can think of it in this holistic way. We can see it in one thought, beginning, middle, end, permutations, variations, deviations. It's so vivid. When you go to write that out, it becomes the thinnest, most anemic line. You're like, oh my gosh, I have to build this up. I have to build this memory up and make it
real. You have to let the reader see all the stuff that you think is just like, oh, that's just the dressing, that's known.
Yeah, and that I think is just, you know, if you're a naif when it comes to writing, and especially long forms of, you just think like, oh, this will be easy. I have this story, this story, this story. And yeah, you have to set the scene. And it took, I went back a lot and, you know, just made those scenes more vivid, you know, to try to sort of illuminate things for the reader. And I gained new perspective, to answer your question finally, I gained new perspective as well in those moments of just, because you do kind of become an archaeologist at that moment, because you are trying to sort of unearth the important things that help create a chronology and create a story. And I think it's good for that process. And
And as we were talking, I got to thinking that, you know, when you play music, you play with other people. When you write and work on Portlandia, it is a big group of people making something. But when you write, it's a total solitary thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel most like an artist? Or that's like the most disciplined craft of being an artist when you're sitting and writing?
Well, that's an interesting question because, you know, I think there is kind of this, we romanticize, you know, like the lone artist in our society.
The painter.
Yeah, you know, like the tortured, isolated, lone artist, like toiling away. Partnerships and creative ones have always been very paramount for me in my life, and I don't see them as making me invisible. You know, I don't feel less than by adding in someone else or by collaboration. Like, to me, I become, in some ways, my better self, my more visible self, or almost like the side of me that I somehow couldn't bring to the world on my own, somebody else helped get me there. You know, it's almost like, yeah, it's like it feels very expansive. That being said, now having done something that was very much a solo endeavor, I'm really proud of it. It's really hard. And there is, I don't think that this methodology is something that I want to return to for other projects, but it gave me, I think, the confidence that, you know, other things going forward don't always need to be in tandem. But I feel lucky to to be engaged with both, because I think that there are things you can get collaboratively that you can't get on your own.
Sure, yeah.
But in terms of a point of view, you know, in terms of just a single, you know, kind of incisive idea, and, you know, that I like having to be married to that. And I also, not that that's not mutable or won't change, but I also like, you know, it's like, this is my book to defend. This is, you know, this is my thing. There's such, it feels very exposed in that way of just like, there's no one to say, well, actually that was Fred's idea. So he can talk to you, you know, it's like,
right.
So I'm really proud of it, but also realize like, no, I mean, I'm, you know, this is a risk that I feel glad to have taken, but also it's new for me.
Well, I think what it does that's different is that it puts the reader in that sort of place in limbo where you realize how much responsibility an artist has to take on, mm-hmm. because there's decisions that need to be made, and there are, you know, there are obviously partnerships that need to be taken care of, and when those things don't work, then you have to look at yourself as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the whole public part of it that I'm sure when, you know, when you're a kid and you're writing your first couple songs and you're feeling that sound in the basement the first time or whatever, you don't think about, you never imagine what would happen if you lost your private life or if your narrative became not just your own or mm-hmm. became out of your control. And you know, you write this thing that really drove that home for me about the first Spin article when you had the first major feature, and you talk about, you know, being very excited you guys were going to be mm-hmm. in Spin, and it was a big feature and there was a photo shoot and all those things. But then the writer went off and did sort of his own investigative journalism and ended up outing you and Corin in a relationship before your parents had known and before her parents had known, and all of a sudden it was like, it was almost like, you know, the fish that swims down river and sees food and doesn't know there's a hook in it,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just
mm-hmm.
like, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like maybe right there, that's that moment, maybe even more than the CMJ and seeing mm-hmm. Thurston Moore in the audience of, oh, this thing's not just mine anymore, or it's a loss of innocence. Because it seems like in the book that sort of scarred you in the way you decided to be protective mm-hmm. of the band since then.
Yeah, I think so, and I think your analogy of the fish and the fish hook is apt, because I think it did create inserted into this world something poisonous, you know, something that could be pernicious and harmful and just a wariness of like what we give up, you know, when we like move.
You don't know
in
what
that
you
direction.
Give up until you give it up, right?
Yeah, and
you can't know.
Yeah, and to sort of, I mean, I think again, like, you know, you were talking about how young we were, like, and we were very unsavvy. But yeah, I think it definitely instilled in me kind of a wariness of being like too exposed, and also just realizing that there is a difference between what I valued in terms of public and private, I kind of shifted more into like, this is what I'm going to protect, you know, these things that are private and that I want to hold dear, they never need to see, they never need to sort of exist for someone else. I don't need to perform you know, a relationship for the world to see, like,
right.
you know, because I'm performing everything else. So it definitely instilled in me a certain sense of like skepticism, and also like, well, that's the reality and that's fine, but I don't necessarily want that. I don't need everything to exist on a stage. I was telling someone else though that I was very grateful to have that moment be pre-social media.
Yeah.
Because it just felt like the only conversation I really had to have was with myself. You know, I didn't need to have a conversation with Twitter and people tweeting at me. I didn't need, you know, a huge, like, argument or op-ed pieces to be, not that it would make that much noise, but, like, I didn't need, like, commentary from whomever, you know, like,
right.
some online blog or, like, sometimes I feel like the discourse surrounding something just, it becomes bigger than the thing itself. And you, if you're the person that's being talked about, I mean, you kind of wither under this, like, avalanche of words, you know?
Well, you know, there is that aspect of the book that I think, one of the reasons maybe I found it so fascinating was that it's just not an area that a lot of people describe. And in a way, it almost romanticizes being an artist more because it makes it so authentically like, yeah, this is a real experience. It's full of ups and downs and full of difficulties and challenges. And it's almost like that old saying, when you're really truthful about something, that's the most interesting thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, the whole recounting of sort of the breakup of the band, mm-hmm. like you say, it isn't salacious, and I agree it's not salacious, but you know, the end of the band was not, it wasn't, you know, it was difficult, and mm-hmm. and it sort of coincided with the breakdown that you were having, mm-hmm. and you know your mom in the story, mm-hmm. she's a factor in the book, and she gets sick up until your parents' divorce, mm-hmm. and then she sort of disappears from the narrative, mm-hmm. and I took that to assume that she sort of disappeared from your life and that you lived with your father, mm-hmm. but I also wonder, I don't know. I felt like when you described the chapter in Brussels where the band is basically breaking yes. up before the show, I found it like so moving that here's someone that just did not have like someone to take them under their wing, mm-hmm. you know? And maybe I'm making a connection where it doesn't exist, but I wonder if you ever thought like if those moments of difficulty for you, if you felt they were related to kind of losing your mom at a critical point in your life.
Well, my therapist would probably agree with you. he just ran down like a real, real psych 101 of my mom leaving. Of course. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the book is about creating, like, trying to find a version of family, you know, where I, you know, had none, you know, and in place of one. And to find, you know, something that I could feel held by. And I think that's what was so scary about Sleater-Kinney, I think for me, it was, and why it was so volatile, is because if a band is sort of a substitute for a family, I mean, you, and I think it is for a lot of people, you know, all kind of partnerships become these substitutions, and so there's a lot of transference. So that's a lot of weight to put yeah. on something. And, you know, I can hear it in our music. I think that's part of why, you know, this band is can be so just galvanic and fearless and fiery and all those things. But of course, I think in that moment in Brussels, which I don't want to spoil, but it was, you know, I think there was just a moment where, you know, I was basically like going to reenact my own betrayal, you know, and it just really like it came out quite forcefully, you know, and I sort of abandoned the band, you know, like these two people that had been around for a very long time for me.
And did it ever strike you as insane or ironic that you were trying to find stability by becoming a touring musician?
Of course, that's what broke up the band. It was just like, how is this? I'm basically like, you know, tied my rope to the least, you know, like a sinking ship, like a ship that's always going to have holes and in need of repair, you know, and we're going to like, continue this metaphor, we're going to dock for just moments and put the anchor down for a second, and then we're going to have to keep going. So it's like the moments that feel steady and calm are few and far between, you know?
Right.
And actually, Korn sang about that on The End of You. She posited the whole analogy about the band in a ship, and it did feel like that. It was a very, a seaworthy ship, but certainly barnacle-laden and and leaky.
With sailors and, you know.
Oh, we're just going to keep going with it, yeah.
Whiskey. And,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I could talk about the book forever. I really enjoyed it. But I do want to get to that sort of 10-year period. Mm-hmm. But right after the band, what I found so fascinating in my research was that you were almost turned into a miniature factotum. You know, like you became a substitute teacher, you wrote a blog, you volunteered at a humane shelter and end up ended up turning into a job.
Yes.
You worked at Wieden and Kennedy, which is an ad agency. Mm-hmm. And I read this and I think, like, this is insane. Here's somebody who's, she was like touring the world. She has the respect of music fans worldwide. She, you know, she's her own boss. And I imagine at some point you're sitting in an office punching a clock at Wieden Kennedy going, what am I doing? I mean, did you ever have, did it ever cross your mind, or were you just so intent on making a left turn away from the band at that point? Because I find that to be amazing that you got to this place that so many people want to get to,
mm-hmm.
and then you sort of went back, not backwards, but you went the other direction.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think...
That's a book for me, I think.
Yeah, well, that'll be the second book. I think that I had always... I'd always looked out from the band thinking that there must be some other version of a life that didn't feel so chaotic.
I imagine some substitute teacher looking out the window going, I really want to be in Sleater-Kinney. And then you're looking out the window, the two of us go, I'd love to be a substitute teacher.
Yeah, I felt that a lot. I think I described this in the book or mentioned it, but early on we would play colleges because that's who paid us the most money. And we would sleep, you know, on floors in dormitories at, like, Yale and Bryn Mawr and, you know, Smith and Columbia. And I was just thinking, like, oh, I should be in school right now. What am I doing in this band? And then the kids at school would be – I mean, I did go to college, but, you know, they would be like, we wish we were on tour. What are we doing in this,
yeah.
you know, trying to get an education at this fancy university, paying a bunch of money. You know, it was definitely a grass is greener syndrome. I think that when Sleater-Kinney ended – I wanted to find salvation in the mundane, no offense to anyone working an office job, but it was very appealing to me, consistency. Not the mundane, more the quotidian, just consistency, ritual, like something that I just thought by doing the same thing every day, like somehow, again, I was going to create those walls that I had never felt surrounded me, you know, that like, and it just, yeah, it was about ritual and routine and trying to get a sense of the minutes in a day, you know, trying to like keep track of things that I felt had kind of slipped from my consciousness, you know.
You were just looking for some safe place that had
yeah.
that had boundaries that were defined, right?
Yeah, you know, things that existed not because of me. No, I didn't have to build the structure in order to put
right.
myself in it, which is what I had done. You know, I mean, I basically left my house when I was 17 and I never went back. And I had spent, you know, the next 15 years, like, creating every, like, vessel that I could put myself in. And
it's tiring, right?
Yeah, I created every lifeboat. And I was like, you know what, I'm done.
We're back on the boat.
Yeah, we're back on the boat. There's so many... I mean, I just love the sea thing. but I just, you know, finally I was like, you know what? I'm done. Like, I just, let me sit inside something. And I think it goes back to that thing at the beginning of the book, I've always felt unclaimed. And it's like, what can claim me? What has the strength? What is monolithic enough? What structure is strong enough? Well, clearly not one I've created. You know, those aren't holding me in. So, but like, look at this big office building. You know, it really felt like that. And, but of course, because I don't know how to sort of like settle in, it's like I picked 10 office buildings. It was just like NPR, Wieden and Kennedy, the Humane Society. But I did, I did feel a weird sense of calm for a while, you know?
Yeah.
And then I describe an experience in that book that kind of had the reality and the grief kind of come crashing back into my life. And I think actually after that is when I went back into more creative endeavors.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, I can't cobble together a structure that has to come from inside me at some point. It's just realizing, like, you know, I can try to, you know, assemble something that's going to hold me, or I can just work on myself so that where I am, I feel held, I feel steady.
So around the end of 2014 or so, you guys keep this big secret that you've actually gotten together, you've
mm-hmm.
recorded a new record. So I'm wondering when you got back together, how, I mean, if there were some immediate things about the music industry that that you looked at differently, or you had to approach differently, or if it was just since you were sort of going all along, you did Wild Flag for a record. But I just wonder what was different. What was the biggest different thing for you guys when you got back together?
You know, in some ways, I think it was a relief because, you know, so much of Sleater-Kinney had existed in this really strident paradigm that it was either placed upon us with external definitions or that we kind of placed ourselves in order to adhere to some invisible code or, you know.
And
so actually coming back and not worrying about all those things, it actually posited us very well in the current environment. I mean, we still, like, obviously, like, our... It wasn't like, it wasn't ambivalence or apathy, but it was actually quite a relief. And I think that one thing we found, and maybe because we weren't trying to, like, exhume a corpse or, you know, sort of, like, do, you know, hey, remember this thing? Now we're going to, you know, we weren't thinking in terms of nostalgia or sentimentality. We were really thinking in terms of being relevant and feeling very, you know, present. So it worked for us because when we started playing shows and because we had put out a record and to just do a reunion tour, our audience was young. I was like, that was such a relief to me. There were 16-year-olds in the audience. There were college kids in the audience. There were people in their 30s who had maybe just caught the tail end of us but had never seen us. And then there were people that had been around the first time. And that, to me, was such a relief, and I think part of it was because we didn't return mourning the past. And because the past for us, as wonderful and grateful as we were for it, it had ended in kind of a dark place. We were ready to not be where we were with the Woods. I actually think all the ways that the music industry had changed had changed us too, for the better, and not our music, and not our sense of urgency, but just that way of like, oh, there's kind of more room to breathe right now.
Was it part of it to just see if, because I feel like in some ways, No Cities to Love, which is the record you just put out, it may be my favorite record of all of your records. I'm not someone that says, oh, the early things are always the best. I feel like you guys have grown with each record. I love The Woods. I mean, it was tortured and dark and everything.
I know, I love that record too.
I love it, and I feel like, you know, you didn't come back to take a victory lap and then put out the perfunctory record to go along with it at all. But I guess I'm asking if once you prove that to yourself, do you ever feel like now, like, oh my God, I have taken on so much and like, yeah, I can do this and I proved it, but now I have to go on tour. Like, does that...
Yeah, well, and then the epilogue of the book, you know, speaks to a little bit of that just initial dread, I guess, about, you know, embarking, like, oh, here I go again. Wow, is this is this really what I wanted? But we also, I think, the part of it that where experience does come into it is that we really take care of each other in Sleater-Kinney. Like, we are very attuned to everybody's needs, sensitivities, anxieties. So it's a kinder version. I mean, we toured a lot when the record came out, and then we had to stop mostly because I then launched into Portlandia and other things. But I don't know. I think when you take things for granted less, which we are not taking this band for granted. You just kind of figure out how to do it. You know, maybe we'll make another record. I think we will, but it doesn't feel like we're on like this, that sort of like hamster wheel of like, oh my God,
right?
Okay, we wrote a record this year. We're going to tour for 2 years, and we got to write. You know, like that. We've broken that cycle, and that's I think a big relief.
Right. I wonder, you know, with Portlandia, if there's a similarity to that cycle though, because, you know, I should explain for people who don't know the show that you and Fred Armisen have this show called Portlandia, and it started out really as sketch comedy that has expanded to more of these characters that we know and love having longer, like one show can be, you know, it's just one story instead of sketches. And I feel like in a way, Portlandia is sort of following an album cycle in that it seems like you're trying to break things down, and I would imagine that once you started doing it, and tell me if this is true or not, but do you get to sort of see behind the curtain and see this, the structure of storytelling and the architecture of comedy to the point where you now have this confidence that you can take a small observation and through crafting and shaping and work, you can, like, it doesn't, in other words, is there a comfort to not having to be all cloud inspiration and knowing that?
Yeah, I don't even know what cloud inspiration is anymore. You know, I mean, I think
that's interesting.
Yeah, I think ideas can come in that space. And I think I do have to set to create space for ideas and brainstorming and, you know, where you're not using your critical mind. You're really just in a place of imagination. I think that is a very crucial part of the process. But then it really is, like, yeah, the structure and nuts and bolts and arcs and beats and all these things. And I think actually, I mean, I see that both with music and with Portlandia. And Portlandia has taught me a lot, I think, about, you know, storytelling and helped me, you know, with the book and even sometimes with the Last Later Kinney record, you know.
Oh, really?
Just, yeah.
In terms of structure of a story within a song?
Yeah, it's just, you know,
or
it all,
point of views.
Yeah, it all helps. I mean, it all kind of feeds each other. But yeah, no, I mean, you need like the free spirited imagination side. But at some point, parameters are good, you know, because then it gives you something to push up against. And it was so easy in Slater Kinney when we felt we were like the whole world was against us. So everything felt like a punch or a kick, you know,
right.
And that we were always had something coming back at us. And I think if you don't feel that or don't have that, like, you have to find a way of creating something, because it helps define what you're doing.
Well, you're talking about, too, I think, that innocent period, the first couple records or the first couple seasons where it's your own little thing and it's you guys against the world, right? And I think that those times are sometimes probably the most fondly looked at,
mm-hmm.
when it was you pushing up against everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I also see in your pattern, it seems like every time you get to a place where, you know, like, dig me out, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, we hit on something on an early record, and the first thing you want to do is go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with Portlandia, you know, you think about a skit like, or a show like The Celery Incident,
mm-hmm.
which is almost like The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it seems like, from where I sit, you're always looking for a new thing to push at. Like,
mm-hmm.
when it gets too comfortable. I mean, is that when it gets comfortable for you, is that when you know it's time to?
Yeah, that's how I feel. And I mean, a lot of other people, I think, don't do that. I think it's fine. I mean, I would admit that I can be restless, and I'm a little bit wary of that, you know, kind of sitting in, you know, stillness, I guess. And but I actually think, I mean, I like to push things quickly. I like to, you know, make things feel different from the last. Although I think there is something to be said. You know, it's too, music and television are interesting mediums, because it's not like, when you think about like visual art, you know, people go through decades of like, well, this was this period of their work.
Right.
You know, and like with TV shows, it's like the cycle's so much shorter. Like, you're not going to just sit in something for 15 years and call it your blue period, you know, or call it, you know, whatever. Like,
sure. But has stretching the boundaries of Portlandia made you desire to like break them entirely or see what you could do outside of that world of those characters? And like, in other words, you know, I'm curious as to what you would do with a one-hour drama after seeing The Celery Incident.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's things that I would want to do outside of Portlandia, just period, in terms of television, but and writing. But within Portlandia, yeah, I definitely feel, as, you know, we're finishing up our sixth season, we have one more, and, or at least one more, I guess. And at this point, I think all bets are off. I would be fine turning in like basically a mini series that's 10, 30 minute episodes that just, you know, is like some true detective or some kind of,
yeah, sure,
you know,
Fargo,
like,
or
yeah, Olive Kittredge, or just, you know, something that's just dark and dry. I don't, yeah, I think we are not adhering to anything anymore on that show, and except to make it good and interesting, you know. But it has veered away from sketch. Like season 4, we really veered away from sketch.
Right.
Season 5, it was a lot of 30-minute, you know, episodes on one theme or one topic. And, yeah, I think it feels very experimental, and I really like it. And it's a fun medium or group of people with which to work, because it does feel very outside of the boundaries of what's happening on television. We've kind of been left alone in our playpen a little bit.
Well, isn't that the greatest setup of all? Like, to be able to do exactly what you want to do.
Yes, but then that goes back to my feeling of parameter. I would love someone, I feel like, you know, just someone to come in and be like, well, what about this? Because then you, I don't know, you just reconnoiter things. It's a delicate balance between you know, freedom and restraint, I think, with your own work. You, I absolute freedom with, it can be indulgent.
I agree, and I think that idea of having a blank page and you could put anything on it is, like, I have kids and, you know, sometimes they'll say, Daddy, let's draw. And then we sit down and they immediately, they don't even think about it. Their pen just goes to the paper and they start, and I'm sitting there going, what am I going to draw? Mm-hmm. And that's the adult going, mm-hmm. I'm in handcuffs because I could put anything down,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the thing, I think, that, if my child says, draw the cat, I'm so much happier.
Yeah.
You know, and I hear what you're saying, though, because if I had to come in every day and draw a cat, I'd go crazy.
Right, but there's so many different cats to draw.
It's a lot of cats.
What is a cat? I mean, you just have to start somewhere.
I think that we've found the meat of this conversation.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think what I hear you saying is that, you know, being satisfied can kind of be the enemy of art sometimes, mm-hmm. but you also have to find some form of sanity to be able to do your best work, right?
We don't want art to be the enemy of satisfaction either, so somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're doing is amazing, and you know, sitting down to do this and getting to go over all of your work again and see new things that I hadn't seen, it was really fun. So I'm a big fan, and
thank
you for coming.
It was really nice to have this very adult conversation with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, in black and white.
In black and white?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Hey folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full Off Camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Off Camera Show or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. Make sure to tune in next time when I sit down with actor, singer, and all-around sweetheart Connie Britton.
When I finally agreed to do Friday Night Lights, I really was very upset with myself because I thought, you know, I'm just going to keep in this cycle of playing these women who are kind of the rah-rah cheerleaders. Peter Berg, he always, always felt badly about the movie. And even during the shoot, he was like, your character is going to suffer. So when the TV show came along, he said, this is our chance to give these women a voice. This is our chance to do that. But I still didn't buy it because, you know, it's still a show about football. But then he left me this message on my machine, which was basically like, Connie, you've got to do this show. We are gonna make this character so amazing. She's gonna be strong and weak and fucked up. And in fairness, Jason Kadams, who really came along to run the show, he basically came onto this thing where I'm standing at his front door like, what are we gonna do for Tammy Taylor, you know?
She shares some great stories about her breakout in The Brothers McMullen and talks about the journey that's led to some of the strongest and most relatable female characters on TV in shows like Friday Night Lights and Nashville. And a certain director from her past returns to ask her about the role that got away. See you next time, off camera.